This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
The inspiration for the League of Women Voters hailed from McLean County.
Democracy must be earned anew by each generation. It is not a danger that confronts us, but the manner in which we meet it that is important.
An episode of McHistory honors Illinois' first female state senator. Mary Cullen reports. You also hear about a new farmer data cooperative that's leaning on the expertise of NASA, plus a 40-year-old sci-fi classic returns to the Normal Theater. That after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Central Illinois farmers are no strangers to cooperatives, becoming a part owner of something that brings back something of value. But a new initiative that involves NASA is asking farmers to pony up something very closely held, their data, all the ones and zeros that a modern high-tech farm produces. I spoke with Dr. Laura Gentry, the Director of Water Quality Research at the Illinois Corn Growers Association, about the new Farmer Data Cooperative and what it means for producers, consumers, and data geeks.
So this is a lot like the standard agricultural cooperatives that farmers are very familiar with, in which they pay in with an investment, usually a cash investment. That's one difference between the data co-op and a standard cooperative. They buy in, and then they're part owners in it, and they get to have direction over decisions that are made, and they get to have input into what's useful or not useful, into management and in this case, the idea is that we are working with these world-class researchers from the University of Illinois, and we have access to a really unique data set from NASA, and the farmers have this opportunity to work with great data and great researchers to help them to produce the types of technologies that are the most useful to them.
So what kind of valuable data is generated on a modern farm?
Oh, we generate so much data on farms today. Many farmers are not making great use of the data that they're generating, which is what one of the reasons that we saw great value in a program like this. But we have farmers that are collecting, of course, yield information from the combines as they run through their fields in the fall. We have variable rate seeding technology, so farmers can decide different seeding rates as they're planting fields based on the soil's capacity to produce crops. We have variable rate fertilizer technology so that farmers can put down more fertilizer in some areas than in other areas based on the soil availability that's already there, and they can do it on the fly as they're moving through the fields. There's auto steer technology. We have so much technology. And then we have sensor data as well that's being used to help farmers make these decisions about what is the appropriate and most efficient ways to fertilize or to seed, what hybrids even to select. We have so much technology. And so bringing all of that together, though, in a way that's digestible for farmers and that results in technology that improves efficiencies. And we see the real value in the university system and in researchers from the universities in this, in that these may not be readily commercializable types of products that we'll be producing, but they would have tremendous impacts in helping farmers to be the most efficient and to have the least waste. So we're talking about reducing nutrient losses, for instance, or reducing greenhouse gas emissions by improving and reducing the number of passes that they need to make, so improving efficiencies there.
And so if I'm a farmer, the data that I'm supplying and bringing into this cooperative, is that sort of like my ticket in? That's sort of like me buying into the thing, is me supplying my data?
That's correct. It may not seem like much to you, but it's actually a really big deal both to the farmer who's contributing the data And it's also a big deal to the researchers who have a really difficult time getting on-farm data because there are so many laws, regulations around confidentiality that a lot of our equipment manufacturers, of course, have to adhere to whenever they put this instrumentation on the different pieces of equipment. And sometimes farmers are very hesitant to make their data readily available to, say, a public university or to any kind of a research institution or anybody who might be using it for their own profit or to sell more product back to the farmer. So data is very powerful, and farmers recognize that. They also recognize the potential for it to even be used against them in some cases, and that has been done, unfortunately. So farmers can be a bit wary about sharing data and with whom they share their data. And so as the Illinois corn growers, we have special relationships with researchers that we know have the best interests of the farmers at heart and the best interests of the environment and improving efficiencies. And those are the researchers that we are working with here. And those researchers see a lot of value in having on-farm data so that they can, as they're getting input from farmers to develop these new technologies, they then have the on-farm data to use to calibrate and validate and improve these technologies to make them more and more valuable for the farmers that use them.
Well, I mean, farmers face a lot of uncertainties right now, you know, between various trade disputes, the unusually wet planting season, I mean, you name it. And how do you think that those things will play into this project and maybe the willingness of farmers to sign up and kick their data into something of this scale?
It is a low price point for the farmer when they feel comfortable that the data that they're releasing is going to be used in a way that brings value back to not just them, but to all of agriculture. So there's that piece. And you're very right that this is a time of uncertainty, and it feels like a lot of risk for farmers right now. Very poor farm economy. Many farmers are just breaking even. Some are even in the red in their farming operations right now and simply can't afford anything that would introduce more risk into their operations. So if we can produce some kind of a technology that reduces risk and helps them to manage their farmland more efficiently, their resources and their inputs more efficiently, that can lead to more confidence in the farming operations. It can lead to changes that can also have benefits to the farmer, and it may lead to things that, such as some of the new ideas behind carbon markets that can, where farmers can receive some payment for changing some part of their management plan. So farmers who participate in a program such as one of these ecosystem services markets or carbon markets can actually stand to make money by participating in a program that would reduce also their greenhouse gas emissions, their environmental footprint, and that's seen as a real win-win. And it also goes back to the consumers who are demanding this kind of change in the products that they purchase. They want to know that they're sustainably sourced or that the products were produced in such a way that was reducing greenhouse gas emissions or working towards some sort of an environmental goal in the long term.
Yeah, I wonder if you can expand on that last point a little bit. I think a lot of our audience, obviously, on WGLT is not farm families, but, you know, we do all have a stake in the food and the cost of food. What should an actuary or a plumber or a teacher, why should they care about a project like this?
I think that we have a lot of communities outside of farming communities, a lot of people who live in cities and towns. They feel a real responsibility to the environment, for instance, and or energy issues, and they want to do something that's positive. And with any minimal amount of education, our consumers, our citizens recognize that the food that they consume and the fuel that they put into their vehicles has a tremendous impact on the environment and on energy systems. And of course, it's also about food security. And so people who are interested in food security, with just one more step down that thought path, they'll realize this is a national security issue as well. There's never been a long-term civilization in history that has been able to maintain its place in the world order without being able to support and feed its country. So food security is a national security issue. And so people who are interested in those or have concerns around national security need to think about how we're going to feed our nation and feed the world too. So these kinds of implications around how we feed our families, ourselves, how we clothe ourselves, how we move ourselves around with transportation fuels, it all comes back to supporting our farmers and helping our farmers to make the best decisions with the ground that they manage for all of our society.
And Laura, one of the project partners here is NASA. You've got this special access to NASA data sets. So what does that mean exactly?
There is a special project that is coming out of NASA. It's called the Harvest Project, NASA Harvest, and it was created with the interest of helping international food security issues. It works with researchers from around the world on the most pressing food security issues in their country. And NASA has selected for the United States researchers in the East Coast at the University of Maryland to work directly with, and also here in the Midwest at the University of Illinois. And they have this unique and very highly coveted among researchers data set of information, satellite imagery, sensor images that they can make available to these researchers. And then the researchers, of course, have this tremendous ability with the computing facilities that are available to them at these universities and the supercomputers to create tools. But then when it all comes right down to it, they don't always have this innate understanding of how to use this tremendous resource and this tremendous knowledge to help farmers on the ground to make these decisions that have a real, tangible, felt impact in our world today. So connecting the researchers and this database with the farmers who are actually making these decisions on the ground seemed like a pretty simple decision, really.
And so how does this all start? How small does this begin? I mean, how many farmers do you try to get into the cooperative at the get-go? And then what is sort of the growth plan from there?
Well, great question. We're working out a lot of this. We're just in the very first months of the beginning, the inception of this concept. And we have had a lot of support. And for those who are in the farming community and also for those who aren't in the farming community, if you see value in this, we would love to hear from you and receive your input. We see that this is going to be a long-term effort, and we want to get as much buy-in from the beginning so that we can represent everybody's thoughts and concerns and ideas from the beginning. So we would certainly welcome anyone's input about this. But the way that this will roll out in the very beginning, this is just beginning with 1 year of this, see how it goes. And our goal really is just to enroll 25 farmers this year into this effort. We've already received quite a bit of interest. We do have room for more farmers, though. So if those are out there, we would welcome working with them. We do pay the farmers a little bit for their time, because there is a time commitment in this. There is an effort that Illinois Corn Growers already has underway that's well established called the Precision Conservation Management Program. It's a farmer service program that helps farmers to make conservation practice decisions. And those farmers, we already have a lot of information about their agronomic management practices. And so they would be very easy for us to move directly into this cooperative since we have a lot of their data already. For farmers that are not already involved in that program, the PCM, Precision Conservation Management Program, we would have to go out and collect information from them. So that's the way that we would start, though, is we would just ask them to reach out to us, and we would be in touch with them about their availability, their viability for being in this effort, and we would go from there.
That's Dr. Laura Gentry, the Director of Water Quality Research at the Illinois Corn Growers Association, speaking about their new Farmer Data Cooperative. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating extraordinary local residents who give back to our community. Submit your nomination for the Philanthropist of the Year Award through July 31st. Nomination forms available at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. In the decade after women's suffrage, leaders of the female empowerment movement were eager to become more involved in governmental affairs. WGLT's Mary Cullen produced this episode of McHistory honoring Illinois' first female state senator and the inspiration for the McLean County League of Women Voters.
Democracy must be earned anew by each generation. It is not a danger that confronts us, but the manner in which we meet it that is important. It can either destroy or help us on the way.
What we're hearing here are the a typed memoir dated 1945 by one of the more extraordinary individuals in McLean County history, Florence Pfeiffer Bohr. Let's go back to January 7th, 1925. Florence Pfeiffer Bohr is about to be seated in the Illinois State Senate and become the first woman ever to become an Illinois State Senator. Not a U.S. Senator, but an Illinois State Senator. So she takes her rightful seat in the Senate chamber at the Illinois State Capitol on January 7th, 1925. This is Bill Kemp, librarian, McLean County Museum of History.
My name is Candace Summers, and I'm the Director of Education at the McLean County Museum of History.
Florence Pfeiffer Bohr, born and raised in Bloomington, no stranger to politics. At the age of 11, her father, Joseph W., nicknamed Private Joe because of his Civil War experience, Pfeiffer is elected Republican governor of Illinois. That's in 1888. So young Florence Pfeiffer Bohr, at the age of 11, will spend the next 4 years living at the executive mansion in Springfield and famously train her little black pony to walk up the steps of the mansion. Yes, that's a true story, believe it or not. So she was a free spirit, a very independent-minded individual, even back then. Then in 1924, this is 4 years after passage of the 19th Amendment, she is drafted to run for the Illinois Senate, because women can run for office, by a group of locally active, politically active, socially active women. So she's basically drafted to run. And as we've said, she assumes office, takes her place on the Senate chamber or chair on January 7th, 1925. And 60 or so women from the Twin Cities and McLean County kind of form a Florence Pfeiffer Bohr Club. That club will then evolve today into the McLean County League of Women Voters.
I had not been in the Senate many weeks before I realized that Senate housekeeping was a full-time job.
Obviously, Florence Pfeiffer Bohr, an extremely intelligent, whip-smart woman with an intense interest in public affairs, but she's hampered to some degree because it's a very patriarchal society, early 20th century America, economically, socially, legally, and politically. So a lot of energy that vibrant women like Florence Pfeiffer Bohr have to be channeled toward organizations, to clubs, to literary societies, but also what we would call today not-for-profit or social justice measures. So Florence Pfeiffer Bohr, before passage of the 19th Amendment, where women are given the right to vote nationally, she helps organize the McLean County Anti-Tuberculosis Society to fight TB or tuberculosis, and plays an instrumental role in the establishment of the Fairview Sanitarium. That building still exists today at Fairview Park in North Normal. Florence Pfeiffer Bohr, though, was a woman of her time, certainly. So, you know, she embraced the role of a homemaker. But to her credit, she viewed homemaking, the role of a mother, to include that of the wider society, not only the neighborhood, but the community as well. It takes a village. In fact, societal problems, your community's problems, the problems down your street are your problems as well. You cannot exist in a vacuum. So she was all about getting out in the community and participating, even in the midst of the restrictions women faced in the age of patriarchy.
Because I happen to be the only woman in the Senate, I have been something of a curiosity, judging by the number of strangers who found their way to my desk.
She is not the first woman, though, to be in the Illinois General Assembly. 2 years earlier, Lottie Holman O'Neill, a state representative from Downers Grove, will be elected. But Florence Pfeiffer Bohr of Bloomington is the first woman to serve in the Illinois Senate, but not the first in the Illinois General Assembly.
My schedule ran something like this. Up in the morning at 7, breakfast with women members of the House to consult about items of interest, then to the State House to read mail and answer letters before visitors and lobbyists began to arrive soon after 9.
She's a re-elected in 1928, so she serves 2 full terms in the Illinois State Senate. That's 8 years. She's known for her support and advocacy of state charitable institutions and helping to overhaul child welfare laws in the state, antiquated child welfare laws. And in her first term, she has the honor of introducing the bill to make Illinois the official state song. And if you're not familiar with that, Illinois, we are fortunate to have one of the more beautiful state songs, and that was sponsored by Florence Pfeiffer Bohr. So that's one of her claim to fame, if you will.
In this day of organization, few persons seem to accomplish great things alone. In politics, I first learned the essential thing is what can we give, not what can we get, and this applies equally to the field of religion.
She did struggle, butt heads against the patriarchal legislature. For example, she sponsors a bill requiring fathers, upon proof of maternity, to support children born out of wedlock. It makes perfect sense to us. But she could only get one vote in the Illinois State Senate, and that one vote was hers. And she would say it was still a man's world and a man's legislature. So she did have frustrations at times. But she was known to work well with her colleagues and work well with those from the opposite party as well.
In spite of daily headlines, tornadoes, and taxes, I am optimistic about the future. It is possible to build a better world. As I see it, our country has stood as a beacon light to all freedom-loving people, and although there are forces at work today to destroy those freedoms, the youth of our land will certainly rise to a keener understanding of the gifts our forefathers handed down to us.
She runs for a third term, but she's buried in a Democratic Party landslide of that year. She grew up and lived on the east side of Franklin Park, and that house is still there. And there are 2 Illinois State Historical Society markers, one to her father, Joseph W. Private Joe Pfeiffer, Illinois governor elected in 1888. But there's a newer one, dedicated, honoring, commemorating the life and career of this amazing woman, Florence Pfeiffer Bohr, the first woman ever to serve in the Illinois State Senate.
This episode of McHistory was produced by WGLT's Mary Cullen, featuring Bill Kemp and Candace Summers from the McLean County Museum of History. This is Sound Ideas. Temperature swings from cool and wet to hot and humid can affect your garden and landscape in both good and bad ways. In this edition of WGLT's gardening podcast, Grow, ISU's Patrick Murphy tells Mike McCurdy how to react to swings in the weather.
Summer finally feels as though it's arrived in the Midwest after a generally cool, wet spring. What does that hold for the garden and landscape, both good and bad? I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your podcast source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Patrick, thanks for stopping by for another edition of Grow.
Great to see you, Mike.
So a cool, wet spring followed by what feels like a humid blast furnace. What are the benefits and what are the drawbacks of those kinds of that kind of weather?
It does feel like that, Mike, but the potential for a great deal of growth for everything in the landscape, from the turf to trees, is kind of the product of this cool, wet spring. Trees and woody plants will flush more growth due to the early cool, wet conditions, but when the temperatures quickly change to higher temps, there are some problems that you could face.
So some of those problems, you want to start with turf?
Yeah, turf is a this one's hard to convince people of, but when you mow during the high sun hours, the heat hours put a lot of stress on your lawn and may invite weeds.
That might be like 2 to 3 p.m., something like, or I'm sorry, 11 to 3 p.m.
Yeah, that's right. And if it's in the full sun, when the late afternoon sun is setting, starting at like 4 o'clock, you get a different angle of this direct sun in the summer. Turf mowed during the heat of the day, it's done so every day without cause. I'm not trying to say that you can harm your lawn by doing that. However, the turf loses a lot of stored water through evapotranspiration after the plants have had the top cut off. So when you mow along, hopefully you're not cutting more than one-third of the total height of the plant, but you're basically leaving an open cut, and a lot of moisture can escape there. The shorter turf then provides less insulation for the water that's stored in the soil's top 2 to 3 inches where most roots are located.
So I sometimes have to mow when it's convenient to mow, when I have the time to actually do it. It sounds like the key, if that's my approach, is to make sure I am cutting it high. Don't cut off more than a third.
That's the first rule. Don't cut off more than a third. And a lot of people mow their grass just too short. And it's a preference and taste issue.
What about weeds in the turf? How do swings from cool to wet, then to highs in the 90s, affect weeds in the lawn?
The thing about the weeds is that they love the extremes. A good sunbathing of the ground, previously shaded by the lawn, can activate weed seeds that are just kind of laying in wait in the soil for an extreme. Extremes are oftentimes what weed seeds need to germinate.
So just like when we were talking about moisture, does when you mow have any effect on weeds?
It can have a lot of impact on the weeds. If we're mowing at the end of the day, we're putting the turf in the shade so it's not cooking in the sun all day. Sometimes that's all it's needed to get those weed seeds to activate. A lot of times, too, I see this where people string trim too close on edges, and then they expose the soil there, so you can really get into trouble with weeds in that location.
Yeah, guilty on that point.
Shade for the ground from taller grass plants, along with the likelihood of taller grass plants sending their roots further down, that's kind of the product of not mowing too short, not mowing when it's really hot out.
So you get better grass root growth.
You get better turf development.
That's about the frequency of mowing?
Some lawn growth slows way down during the heat of the summer, and even the untrained eye can see the green color kind of slipping away. So you can sometimes get away with longer intervals between mowings. You know, so in the spring and fall when the soils are cool, we're mowing as frequent as every 4 days. Sometimes a week is more like it. During the heat of the summer, you can skip mowings and keep the place looking tidy just by string trimming the wild whiskers that are here and there.
And let's talk about watering turf and other plants, but let's start with turf. Lately, not much need to water, but the time is coming.
Right, and we don't want to waste water. That's something that's very important in the people that appreciate living things, and especially those in biological sciences. So knowing that, you don't want to ever engage in a hasty watering. That's kind of a watering that makes you feel good, but it's not that great for your garden. Watering for turf, trees, and herbaceous plants should be conducted in the mornings. And if there's an irrigation system involved, that's also the best time to conduct the watering. If it's not with an irrigation control system, deep and frequent soakings at low pressure from the garden hose are the best way to put the water where the plants can get it while wasting as little water as possible.
So there's never really a need to water leaves, right?
The leaves don't really gain anything from getting a bath.
So watering should happen at the base of the plant.
That's right.
What's the harm in soaking the plant or running a sprinkler that soaks the entire plant and the water just dripping off on it and then, to the soil and the roots?
There is a possibility that, particularly for your shade-loving plants or plants that have a larger leaf surface, that you say you soak them down there in the morning after you finish your coffee, and they don't dry out readily because of high humidity, perhaps, or it's a still day. There's not wind to help blow it off. So little droplets of water on leaf surfaces. And think about Japanese maples for a minute, because a lot of people have seen the leaves on Japanese maples. They have little holes in them like somebody shot it with a shotgun. Well, that's from moisture a lot of times. It's resting on the leaf. And it can be pronounced to the effect that the moisture is like a magnifying glass for the sunlight that comes down, and it starts to damage the leaf, and then the little damaged spot turns into a hole, and then it spreads to a tear. Hmm. So the plants don't gain anything from having themselves washed off all the time.
Do darker leaves have more of a problem than like a lighter green, a dark green, or, you know, sometimes a Japanese maple is a red or a dark red? And there's some trees I've seen on campus here that the leaves are almost look like a dark brown or black.
The potential is there. So there are a lot of burgundy type leaves that, you know, there's some stereotypes that are true that go along with those plants. But the magnification of the sun through the water, that can happen with green, chartreuse, burgundy colored, all pretty much the same. A lot of times those burgundy colored leaves are fuzzy, or they have a hair on them, which makes the moisture stick around even longer.
I've heard that if you water roses and spray the entire plant, that can also lead to disease.
Yeah, I think it can. You can have a foliar leaf spot and things like that. And the big thing to keep in mind is that the roots are the part of all plants that take that water up. So unless the plants have been exposed to like prolonged periods of dryness and there's dust on them, or someone's been, you know, doing concrete cutting and the concrete dust has settled, it's best to save that water that you would bathe the plants with and get it down on the ground where the roots are.
If you really want to be efficient with your watering, I suppose a timer is probably best. You don't have to go for a full irrigation system, but even a timer hooked to your hose and a sprinkler would allow you to water at the right times of the day.
Control is a big part of making sure you're not wasting water, and that anything worth doing that you can measure is a great idea. So the timer, I think that's a fantastic suggestion.
What about soaker hoses?
Soaker hoses are fantastic. Again, because they control the water. A lot of times what happens if you let the hose run and the pressure's too great is that the capillaries in the soil fill up, and then the water is just running on the surface and racing away to areas where it's not needed. Soaker hoses put that water on the ground where the roots are in a controlled manner and over a long period of time. That gives the plants the greatest opportunity to take the water up and the least amount of opportunity for the water to collect on the surface and run away.
If you have any questions about turf watering or how the weather can affect your garden or landscape, or about anything in the garden and landscaping, get in touch and we might answer them on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to WGLT.org/grow.
You can subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Find past episodes at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas.
Multi-course breakfasts are usually reserved for your weekends, but on Morning Edition, we serve up a full meal every day. So you get substance.
Without empathy, we would be just alone.
And something to savor, too.
Live now, love hard, and appreciate everything.
Get your fill of stories from around the world. Start your day with Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for WGLT comes from Community Players Theater, presenting The Addams Family. America's spookiest family comes to life in this new musical comedy about love, honesty, family, and growing up. Running 3 weekends in July. Details and tickets at communityplayers.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. It's hard to imagine a more influential movie in sci-fi cinema than Ridley Scott's 1979 classic Alien. The 40-year-old movie returns to the big screen this weekend at the Normal Theater. I spoke with Normal Theater and Normal Civic Arts Manager Adam Fox about why this movie continues to echo across movie making.
You know, it's interesting because the film came out at a time where space was being presented kind of as one of two things. It was either this really whimsical, fantastical place where everybody was going on an adventure and you were like, I want to go there. That sounds amazing, right? Or it was this really austere kind of ascent into the heavens, right? Stanley Kubrick giving that, you know, Pan Am first class flight into space. And this was the first time, as I've been thinking about it, that you really remember space being presented as just this cold, hostile place that doesn't doesn't care about you, right? Like, space is a dangerous place that will let you die. And there was something really interesting about taking this thing that we'd all been sort of dreaming about and making it this really dangerous place where you go to get hazard pay, right? You go to take a contract, do work that nobody else really wants to do, and get off ship as quickly as possible. And I think that notion of space as a dangerous place and space as something that maybe isn't the dream we have all thought of has influenced so many films and so many TV shows, right? If you watch the Battlestar Galactica reboot, there's so much of that of like, we just need to find water, right? Like just basic survival things that happen with that, or the current show The Expanse and the books associated with it as well, where space is the place you live and don't lose focus for a second, or it's not the place you live anymore. I think it's had just that lasting impact, as well as how the design and the aesthetic of it being very functional, right? It was all very perfunctory, right? Nothing in Alien was something that you really wanted to pick up yourself, right? It was all stuff that was there to do a job. Even the Nostromo itself was a ship that looked like an oil refinery in space, right? It wasn't like the Enterprise tooling around. You're like, that looks awesome. It's like, look at that factory. I don't want to fly in that for 5 years. So I think that that notion of it being kind of a darker place really was the lasting impact.
And it doesn't get a lot much darker than the this famous scene of the little alien popping out of John Hurt's chest in the mess hall. I forgot how funny the scene was, to be totally honest. There's a moment when it first happens and all the actors, Tom Skerritt and all them, are just kind of staring at it. I'm like, what is going on? And then the little alien runs away. And it's funny. I don't know. That's got to be like a top 10 movie scene in history. That's like iconic.
Yeah. And what's great about it is back when I think it was the original DVD release came out, Ridley Scott revealed that he didn't script that scene, that he didn't tell the actors in the scene what was going to happen. They knew the alien was going to appear. And other than, I mean, John Hurt knew what was going to happen. It wasn't like, surprise, puppet. Like, they knew that he knew what was going to happen. But otherwise, nobody else in the room knew that that was the way we were going to see the arrival of this alien. So when you hear the reactions, and there's kind of that stunned sense of what just happened, that's really the actors who had no idea that this explosion was just going to happen on the table. Veronica Cartwright, you hear her kind of doing this running monologue where she's going, oh, what is this? What just happened? And that's like how we would all react, right? We'd like to think that the monster appears and we'd be like, get it. And instead, you know, and eliminate the existential threat. And instead we'd all stare at it, just kind of slack jaw and go, what was that? And it was such an honest reaction that they like did it in one. And that was that. So yeah, it's a funny scene and so horrific. It is kind of amazing. So yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about Sigourney Weaver. This is the movie that made her a star, obviously. And when you think back though, she's not even like first billed in the opening credits. She's after Tom Skerritt, who, spoiler alert, a lot less successful long-term than Sigourney Weaver. And I don't know, what do you think about her in this movie? What does she do that is like, wow, that's a star?
Yeah, you know, she's fantastic in this film. You know, you would use the term, you know, strong female character, but that's not accurate necessarily. She's just a strong character, right? She's just somebody who the whole film is not quoting policy for policy's sake. She's quoting it for genuine safety and looking out for everybody. She's aware of the context and the gravity of the situation. She's the one saying, no, quarantine, don't let them back on the ship right now. What are you doing? Like blatantly telling you what's about to happen later on in the film. So I think there's something about the stability that she brings to it the whole time of saying, look at the situation, assess what's happening, that's coming from what might be a lesser character as far as billing is concerned or as far as rank on the ship is concerned. And I think that's what makes it so compelling, that she's the one that ultimately sees it coming. She's the one that can assess that danger, and she's the one that ultimately can survive. I don't know. Do I have to give spoiler alerts on this? It came out 40 years ago. I feel like you've had your chance, right? But like that she's the one that actually makes it through because she understands what's necessary is, I think, critical and important. And yeah, revolutionary. It was incredible to see her do it. And that character has been cited as an influence for so many characters subsequently. It's really, really phenomenal to go back and see what she did with it because it's unbelievable.
So this one Alien film becomes the Alien franchise because everything, you know, is a franchise. Aliens, Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, Prometheus, Alien Covenant, Alien versus Predator, if we're going to go ahead and count that one. Anyway,
it counts.
It's a whole thing. Yeah. It's a whole franchise. Do you have a personal favorite in this franchise?
You know, it's tough. I love the haunted house aspect of Alien. I think it's so much fun, and I think there's so much surprise that happens in it. But for me, it really is Aliens. That was the one that I remember seeing as a kid, probably way too young. It was the 80s. It was a different time. And that one stuck with me because there was such a sense that now I can retroactively say, you know, of just this hubris that existed amongst everybody being like, there's no threat that we can't stop. Of course we can control all of this. And the sense that it's not a subtle metaphor that a corporation cares more about profits than its people going on. But the tension that exists between all of that and how it just all falls apart and that nature really just overtakes it and that there is this unstoppable force was just so exciting and so unexpected and so refreshing. And it was similar enough to the first film where you saw a lot of those similar beats and you kind of went on that same journey, but it flipped it just enough to make it really fun and take it in different directions. And for me, that's the one that I think was so fun, including, of course, James Cameron's amazing design and amazing direction and how he sort of said, well, this is probably what future tech is going to look like. And now it does, because that's what he was doing in the 80s, was figuring that out. So yeah, so for me, that's got a special place in my heart. But yeah, I love the whole franchise. It's all great.
Adam Fox is a civic arts manager for the town of Normal and runs the Normal Theater. The Normal Theater is screening Alien Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You can't watch this one on Netflix. It's not even there, so come check it out. This is Sound Ideas. Black Dirt Music Festival founder Edward David Anderson says the outdoor event Saturday night next to the Castle Theater is intended to celebrate the best features of Bloomington Normal. The fest includes a reunion of Anderson's Backyard Tire Fire, which disbanded in 2011. Anderson tells WGLT's John Norton the all-local lineup of Backyard Tire Fire, Chicago Farmer, Edward David Anderson's own Black Dirt Revival, Matthew Curry, and John Till was intentional.
Yes, especially for this first one, we wanted it to represent this community. You know, we want this to be a community thing. We want this to be a family-friendly event. This is an outdoor show. You know, this is fun. You know, this is something that we want the whole community to kind of rally around, you know, at least the whole music community. We'd love to get people that aren't even, you know, maybe don't even know who any of these acts are. They're still going to enjoy this, sitting outside and listening to good music in downtown Bloomington, you know.
Well, let's go with the bands then. And one of the bands that'll be appearing is the reunion of Backyard Tire Fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Why?
Well, you know what? It's interesting. When we first developed the concept of the festival and we were talking to the Castle about it, and to be brutally honest, I hadn't listened to any of the Tire Fire material in a long time. I hadn't, I don't really play a ton of it. You know, I wrote a bunch of new songs that kind of moved on, and I had never made a Spotify playlist in my life, and my wife was showing me how to do it, and I found a couple Backyard Tire Fire records on Spotify. And so I made a Spotify playlist of some of my three solo records and then a couple of Tire Fire records kind of mixed in. And I started hearing these songs kind of back to back, and I started getting nostalgic for these old songs that I had written. I mean, they're really, at the time, they meant everything to me. You know, they were the story of my life. They are the story of my life, basically. So I hadn't played them in so long, and I got nostalgic, and I really wanted to play them again. And that's kind of how the whole thing started.
Well, and you've done your solo thing for the last number of years now. And yeah. By the way, these are great albums you're putting out as solo albums. You probably couldn't have done this. You couldn't have redone Backyard Tire Fire 3 years ago then. You weren't ready yet.
No, I wasn't really. And I think that it just seemed like the right time. I don't know. Just hearing those songs and hearing them with my new songs just kind of made me just want to play them again, really. And I felt like at that moment, I kind of suggested to my wife, I was like, well, what would you think that if, and she's like, wow, I mean, I think that'd be a great way to kick this whole festival thing off the first year you guys come back and do a set.
For anyone not knowing, maybe you're new to town, Backyard Tire Fire was a nationally touring band. You guys were playing with major names across the country. They disbanded, what, 2011 you guys kind of disbanded?
Yeah, you know, we the last year of our existence, I think we played a handful of gigs. We were trying to settle up some debts and stuff. And, I mean, it's been almost a decade since we played regularly together.
Is Tim playing with you, too?
Yeah, yeah, and my brother and Scott Tipping on guitar. And, yeah, really? So, yeah.
Oh, this will be great.
Yeah, it's going to be really fun.
Hey, it's okay, it's all right, I'm alive, and it's good to be. It's okay, it's all right.
It's good to be. It's a classic Backyard Tire Fire cut here on GLT Sound Ideas. Our guest is Edward David Anderson, who is reuniting the band for the Black Dirt Music Festival. It'll be in downtown Bloomington in July. Chicago Farmer's on the bill.
Yep.
You can't play without Chicago Farmer. I mean, you guys are like right arm, left arm, aren't you?
Yeah, we do a good bit of gigging together, although it's been a little bit since, you know, since we went down to the beach last winter, and I may have played a gig with him since I've been back, maybe not. So it's been a little while, so it'll be fun to kind of reconnect.
Well, Cody, Chicago Farmer's billed with friends.
Yes.
Who are some of those friends?
Wildermore.
Are you serious?
Wildermore is back in Farmer. It's going to be really cool.
I've been on them to put out a new album, for God's sake.
I know. Yeah. They're so good. They're just a really good band, and I think they're going to be great doing the Farmer material. They're really good at learning other people's stuff. I mean, God, when they cover the Bowie stuff or the Who stuff,
yeah.
How great were they?
That was fantastic.
They obviously have great songs themselves and stuff, but they're really, really accomplished guys that can play, and so I really am excited to hear what they do behind Chicago Farmer.
Well, I know Matthew Curry's trying to make a go of it nationally. He's on the bill, and you're probably sick of me talking about this, how especially you and Cody are getting credited with kind of just rounding up everybody in this community and making it a real cohesive, you know, united music scene.
Sure.
Matthew Curry is from here, but he's, you know, he's touring nationally and stuff, but he's in a different generation than you guys are as well. Well, let me ask it this way. How important is it for a local scene to be able to help each other out and maybe boost each other up, whether, say, I mean, you tour nationally as well.
Sure.
So if you're out on the road, Cody's out on the road.
Yeah.
Talking about the Bloomington Normal music scene, does that happen, and how important is that to help what's going on in town here?
I think it really does, and you know what, a lot of it comes back to the castle. We've talked about it a lot, but like, you know, we'll be out, I'll be somewhere in a different time zone and mention, you know, Bloomington, and be like, someone might be like, is that where that Castle Theater is? You know, like, it's starting to, it's kind of getting known, not just in the Midwest, but nationally. There's a lot of bands coming through here that are really digging that venue, and that's helping kind of put it on the map. And then, yeah, I always kind of talk about, you know, who comes from this town and the people that are out doing it, and try to, you know, pump up what we have going on in this little scene here, you know. And I think Cody does. I'm sure everybody does. I'm sure everybody's out there that's from this town mentioning the other acts that are also from this town that are out there doing it on the national level. It only helps, you know. You know, I'm all about working together and trying to help other people get seen, or helping someone that's working hard at it, that's doing it for the right reasons. I want people to know who they are. I mean, that's, I feel like the more the merrier.
On the banks of the Mackinac, as I threw in a line, almost heard my daddy call, son, you get back sometime. To the great Midwest, where things seem real, the great Midwest.
New song from Matthew Curry, The Great Midwest, here on GLT's Sound Ideas. We're talking about July's Black Turret Music Festival with founder Edward David Anderson. On the bill, Backyard Tire Fire, Chicago Farmer, Edward David Anderson, and Black Turret Revival. That's one band. Mm-hmm. Matthew Curry and John Till.
Yeah.
John's been not been part of this conversation so far.
Yeah.
Why is John on the bill?
Because I love John.
Yeah, he's so much fun.
He's such a good guy, and
a very talented guy.
Yeah, I love what he does. He's a very humble young man, and
he's another guy that is an amazing talent.
Yeah, he gets out there and does it Midwestern, and he's a hard-working young guy, and I love the tunes. I had a really good time when we, you know, worked together on that album, and that was one of the first records that I really got to get my hands on and produce just by myself, and I really enjoyed making that record. And I felt like John, you know, as far as Black Dirt music, I mean, he actually works on a farm. His last name is Till. You know, like, he's as Black Dirt as you can get. So he felt like the right way to kick off the festival would be John to do his one-man band thing.
La-da-da-da-da.
So we talked a little bit about the local scene, and we talked off and on over the years about how it's Bloomington Normal is really bubbling up. There's really something going on here. How much does this add to the scene?
I think it's huge, man. I think that if we can make this
outside the city?
Yeah, I think that if we can make this a thing where we have people travel. I know for a fact there are people that are flying in and driving in from all over the place because of this tire fire thing, because we haven't played in almost a decade, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, next year it's going to be bigger, and there'll probably be some bigger acts, some very known things happening on it as well. I want people to come from all over the place to this town. I want this to help the local economy. I want this to be a thing that grows into a regular, you know, an annual thing that grows into this, you know, this destination where people are going to come to Bloomington every year and go to the Black Dirt Music Festival. One thing that I think that we're really excited about is that a portion of this year's proceeds are going to Habitat for Humanity in McLean County, which is really exciting for us as we want this to be a community-based thing. We want this to be a point of pride for the community. This is something that's going to be a very positive experience for everybody, not just the musicians, not just the music lovers that already go to the castle, but I think that if we can get more people outside of this little music community in the greater community involved, we could really have something special here.
That's Black Dirt Music Festival founder Edward David Anderson speaking with WGLT's John Norton. The inaugural Black Dirt Music Festival begins at 5 p.m. Saturday in the Rock Lot at the Castle Theater. You can discover other local music and hear from artists playing across central Illinois on the WGLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas and WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions, WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen, Mike McCurdy, and John Norton. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. And we want to know what you think of Sound Ideas, so comment on our Facebook page. We're WGLT-FM, or you can follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. Let's hear a bit more from Matthew Curry. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's Public Media.